Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
This is Average Joe Aguirre, joined today by members of our scholar team, astronomer Hugh Ross, biochemist Fuzz Rana, astrophysicist Jeff Zwering, and molecular biologist Anjanette A.J. Roberts. They will be sharing exciting research from the front lines of the scientific journals and discussing the apologetic implications. You will hear from each in roundtable fashion today. We've done the obligatory tossing of the dice, and it turns out that A.J. will be going first today. Welcome to each of you. A.J., we're going to get right to it. You have an exciting report to discuss from a scientific journal about human pig or human cow chimeric studies. Well, let's hear all about it. We've heard some of this before. People are always fascinated about discoveries of this type because we're always looking for medical solutions, scientific breakthroughs, and medical things of this type interest us because we want to keep going on living, right? Is this kind of what we're talking about here?
Well, it's definitely, in some people's minds, sort of science at the boundaries, pushing the boundaries and how far should we go.
Okay.
So I actually had a friend on Facebook ask me about this 2 weeks ago. She's like, what's up with the human pig chimeras? You know, what do you think about that? And I said, well, actually, you know, I blogged about this about 7 months ago, and there's one of my blogs out there called Philosophizing Pigs, Is It Reality or Hogwash? But interestingly, just last month, January of this year, they actually released the first research report on some of the data that they've been collecting since 2014, where they've been trying to generate human-pig chimeras or human-cow chimeras or even human-sheep chimeras. So first of all, a chimera is a mixing of two different species. And so the paper I'm looking at today is from Cell, the journal Cell, and the article is from researchers at Salk Institute and at UC Davis in California and some collaborators in Spain. And the paper is entitled Interspecies Chimerism with Mammalian Pluripotent Stem Cells. But basically, in this report, they're covering a lot of ground, and they eventually get to some of the data on the human-cow, human-pig chimera experiments. And so what they've looked at first is they're trying to see if animals are very closely related. And we've known for some time from other research that you can get chimeras if they're rodent species. So you can take pluripotent stem cells, and stem cells are undifferentiated cells that have the potential to develop into any type of cell in an adult organism. And so pluripotent just means it has a variety of different possible outcomes. And we used to think that the only way that we could get a type of cell that was undifferentiated or naive and could become any other kind of cell is to actually get an embryonic stem cell. And so embryonic stem cell research has been a topic of much heated debate in the public arena. And so just since about 2007, we've found that you can take a fully differentiated cell and you can actually add the right chemicals to that cell and culture, and you can basically unprogram it from its differentiated state, and it's called an inducible pluripotent stem cell because you've induced it back to a naive state. So it now has the potential to be any kind of cell, again, in the right environment. And so what they're doing in these chimera studies is they're taking a recipient animal. In the case of the rat-mouse experiments, the mouse is the recipient animal, and they're taking pluripotent stem cells that they've generated in rat from rat cells, and they're introducing those into the mice, and they're saying, can we get rat cells incorporated into adult mice? And what they find is they can, and that the rat cells will actually go into many different tissues in the mouse, and that mouse-rat chimeras can actually live up to 2 years, which is the normal lifespan for most mice species. And so one of the other things that they've done is most recently, since about 2012, with CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology, they've now said, well, can we go into a zygote? And a zygote is basically a fertilized egg. It's two cells, the earliest stages of embryogenesis or development of the embryo. Can we go into a zygote and basically create an animal through CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology that's deficient in a particular gene, and then allow in vitro for that zygote to continue to develop until it's gotten to a multicellular stage that's called a blastocyst, which is actually a spherical-shaped embryo that has a cavity in the middle of the sphere and a little bit of an inner cell mast, which is sort of like a bulge on the inside of the spherical ball of the blastocyst. Can we take those pluripotent stem cells, introduce them into a blastocyst of an animal that's had particular genes knocked out through CRISPR-Cas9 technology, and can we get those pluripotent stem cells to fill in the gap, provide the genes that we've knocked out? So if you take a mouse and you knock out a gene that's critical for the development of a pancreas, and you introduce rat cells into the mouse blastocyst, and then you take it and you implant it into a mouse and let it go to full term, can you actually get a mouse that's born with a rat pancreas? So what they show in this paper is that you can do exactly that. If you take mice and through CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing, you knock out the gene for either pancreas development, another gene for development of the eye, another gene that's really important in general development and development of the heart, that if you knock those out, you can basically supplement in those functions by providing rat pluripotent stem cells. And the rat cells come to the rescue and provide the pancreas and the eye and the heart.
And there's no rejection or harm?
Well, so it doesn't work all the time, right? Okay. So that's in those particular experiments that I just described, about 50% of the time you get spontaneous abortion. So the embryo won't go to full term. Another 30%, so that's 50%. Another 30%, you don't get a chimera. You just get a mouse. That, you know, if it's deficient in a gene that's critical, like the one that's responsible for the heart, the embryo doesn't even make it full term. If it's something that provides function for a pancreas, well, mice without a pancreas can actually be born, but they die within a couple of days after birth. And so 30% are non-chimeric, and another 20% are actually chimeric. So it's a very low efficiency, and that's animals that are fairly close or similar, related to one another, right? They're all in the rodent family, rats and mice. So now they're wondering if you can do it with animals or species that are more dissimilar. So they did some initial experiments with rat cells and pig blastocysts. And in this case, they haven't manipulated the pig blastocyst. It's the wild-type pig, right? It hasn't been knocked out for any genes. And they just introduce rat cells, and they say, can the rat cells be incorporated into the pig embryo and basically make a chimeric tissue within the pig? And what they find there is the answer is no, that rat cells don't seem to incorporate into pig embryos at all. And so now they're wondering if we could do it with human cells. In they've tried it in other experiments, have tried it in human cells in mice or rats, and that hasn't worked. And they've thought, well, that's because we're very different developmentally. So maybe we're too far apart. But the ungulates, animals like pigs and cows, have more similarities with us as far as like organ development and embryo development and timing and that sort of thing. And so they're wondering if we can do human cells, pluripotent stem cells, into an ungulate, into a cow or a pig. And so the initial experiment that they report is in a cow, and they've basically taken pluripotent stem cells from humans at different stages. So you can be completely naive stem cell. You can be a primed stem cell, which is already sort of ready to go down a particular lineage to a particular type of tissue, or you can be intermediate between those. And so they've taken three different phases of stem cells and said, are one of these phases the best? Because you have to match the developmental timing if you want chimeras to actually work. If you don't match them developmentally in their timing, you're not going to get success. They've learned that from previous studies. And so what they basically are reporting here is that if you take a completely naive human cell, pluripotent stem cell, or an intermediate one, and you introduce it into a cow blastocyst, that after you introduce it, about 2 days later, you'll actually see some of the human cells in the inner cell mass of the cow embryo. But that's as far as they report their findings in human cow. And it's only working with the naive and the intermediate human cells. It's not working if they're already primed for a particular lineage. So now they're asking the same thing in the pig, and that's sort of the climax of the paper is, can we get this to happen in a pig? Because one of the things that this type of science is hoping to accomplish for us is to create animal donors for human organs, right? So that we no longer have to wait for a human donor if somebody's terminally ill and needs an organ transplant. If you could provide human pancreas or human heart or human kidneys or human lungs from a pig, then in theory you could produce these as needed, right? And you wouldn't have to wait for something tragic to happen to another human
because
being.
The organ is growing in that animal.
That's the hoped for one of the hoped for end goals of this type of research.
Okay.
You know, can we create a chimera, a pig that's able to produce a human heart so that we could use that human heart so that people, you know, thousands of people die every year
because they're on a waiting list.
Organ transplant waiting lists. That's right.
Okay.
And so maybe no one will ever need to die waiting for an organ again if we can get this kind of science to work. And so what the research has found, without leaving you hanging too much longer, in the case of the pig, the naive human cells don't seem to work very well. They didn't even try the primed human pluripotent stem cells because they failed in the cow. And the intermediate pluripotent stem cells actually do work somewhat better than the naive cells do, which barely worked, rarely worked. But it doesn't work at even an efficiency that's comparable to the rat mouse chimeras. So it's a very low level. If you take rat pluripotent stem cells, put it into a wild-type mouse, the most enrichment of rat cells that you find in mouse tissues are the mouse heart, and about 10% of the heart cells come from the rat. This is also kind of interesting. I don't know if we'll go there. Anyway, if you want, you can follow up with a question about rat gallbladders. But anyway, back to the pigs. So what they basically did in the pigs is they looked at four different types of primed cells, and they ended up creating 1,300 zygotes, which is the fertilized egg stage, and the first reproduction after that, the two cell stage, and then something called a morula, which is about 4 to 8 cells. It's a spherical ball. It hasn't quite formed the sphere that has a cavity in the inside, but the morula is, and so. Altogether, they took about 2,400 blastocysts and implanted them into sows. And they asked out of that how many of them actually incorporated human cells. And I'm looking for those figures as I flip my pages around. And so what they actually ended up doing, because they were doing human pluripotent stem cells and rat pluripotent stem cells in pigs in parallel, they ended up with just over 2,000 blastocysts that had introduced human pluripotent stem cells into a pig blastocyst. And they've taken those now, and they're transferring them into sows to bring them to the embryonic stage where they can start to develop into embryos and get organ differentiation in the embryos. And so they've implanted 2,075, and what they end up finding 21 to 28 days later, they were able to recover around 1,450 embryos. So right away, you've already lost about 500, 600 embryos that didn't remain viable or didn't implant. And then from those 1,400 and roughly 50 embryos, they actually, that's how many they actually injected, sorry. From those, they actually got 186 embryos recovered at 21 to 28 days. So they lost a lot, right? You basically are putting
in. Who's they, by the way?
The scientists, the ones from California and Spain, the ones that authored this paper.
It's a joint effort.
Yeah, there's actually several groups that are doing this type of research. There's some in Minnesota, there's some in California, there's, I think, maybe some in Florida, and some in Spain. So this is a collaborative report from the folks in California and Spain.
Okay.
So they've, out of 1,400 and 50, roughly, embryos that they implanted, they actually only got 186 viable embryos 21 to 28 days later. And then when they look at those, what they find is those that more than half of those embryos are of retarded growth size for where they should be. So they say, number one, taking human pluripotent stem cells and putting it into pig blastocysts seems to have some type of negative overall growth effect, right? So you can tell that from numbers of embryos lost and from reduced size of embryo. But of the ones that are of normal size, and of the normal-sized embryos at day 28, there were just about 100. There were 99. And of those, only 17 were positive for a chimeric signal. So all the rest were non-chimeras, right? So it's very, very, very low efficiency. But they're still hopeful, and they say that, you know, they still have this goal of possibly doing the directed knockout of a particular gene to make it a better recipient model for maybe forcing the human cells into meeting a need that the pig's now deficient in and actually producing, for instance, a pancreas, right? So I'm sure that they've actually been doing those experiments, or at least I would speculate that they have. Although, now that I've said that out loud, I could also say, well, maybe not. Maybe they're still trying to work out the methodology because they didn't know which phase of pluripotent stem cell would work best. You know, so this paper's helped them identify that it's the intermediate pluripotent stem cell that should give them the best results. So now that they've identified that, maybe they'll go on to try and knock out genes in a pig zygote and then replace that organ with human pluripotent stem cells. Anyway, I find it fascinating. And yeah, people were wondering, you know, sort of what's your take on this? Is this weird science, things we shouldn't be doing? I would encourage you to take a look at my blog article because I kind of address those issues in that article. But I know that Fuzz, too, has written about chimeras in the past as well. And
or I may have done a podcast or two, but yeah, they were a different type of chimera than what you're describing here. Those were, that I did podcasts on a number of years ago, were where they were using cloning technology, and they were taking an egg from a human and then enucleating the egg and then adding a nucleus from, let's say, a cow cell.
Yeah.
And making that kind of a chimera. And then those they would then stimulate to go undergo cell division. And typically after two or three rounds, the embryo would just peter out. And
still in vitro before embryonic transplant? Or
Yeah. They didn't. Yeah, it was all in vitro. Yeah, but, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about this technology, because the idea of xenotransplantation has been in play for a while.
Long time.
And one approach that people initially were exploring was the use of cloning, where they would generate pigs that had genes knocked out that produced certain cell surface sugars that caused hyperacute rejection.
Right.
And so by eliminating those...
So basically modifying the proteins or the sugars in the pig organ.
Right, so that the pig organ could be implanted into the human. So it was a idea of xenotransplantation. Of course, you still have a rejection issues, and then you also have the concern about introducing retroviruses into the recipient from the donor pig. But what's interesting about this is that you could actually avoid rejection issues if you could get the technology to work, because if I'm a patient and I need, let's say, a liver transplant, I could donate a skin cell.
Right.
That
right.
You could get into an induced pluripotent stage and then
that's right.
Implant it. So it's a really interesting technology.
You could sort of try to customize it that way, but with the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing tool, they actually have gotten to the point where I think they're able to knock out 60 genes that are related to these types of antigenic targets in pigs that might prevent organs that were grown or produced in pigs from being good organs for human transplant. So there's so many different layers that these types of questions can be addressed scientifically now, which I think is incredibly exciting. I think it's another thing that we could use it for, not just for transplants. You know, I'm not really sure if I was needing a heart and the only heart available was one that was coming from a pig, if I would choose to take it. I think most people would. I might still be a little bit weirded out over the thought, but one of the other applications is if we could grow pigs that had human organs and some of the human diseases that we have, we don't have good animal models for because those disease pathogens don't grow well in the animal model, but they grow well in human tissues or human organs. It's feasible that we could actually develop chimeras that would be great animal models for studying human diseases, and especially maybe diseases of the brain, right? We can't do any kind of experiment on human diseases of the brain in animals because they just seem to they fall short in so many ways. So I think it's a great example how if we're thinking carefully about what's being done, if we understand the science, and if we're involved in public dialogue, that this type of science can actually be used to help us steward our resources for human well-being and human thriving.
So. Hey, a clarification, because it sounded like what you said earlier was that you needed to take the stem cells from the human when the human was still in the developmental stage?
No.
So you can take them from anybody?
Well, because you can now induce pluripotent stem cells, you can take a somatic cell, you can take a fully differentiated adult cell, like a skin cell, and you can put it in vitro with, I think it's just four transcription factors that are needed to induce that fully differentiated stem cell back into basically a naive or a primed, back into a primed human stem cell. But then you can take that primed human stem cell and culture it in a couple of different medias and actually force it back into a further naive state.
So in other words, what you're saying is I'm not too old for this technology.
No, you're not too old.
All right.
And that's another application, right? We can actually use these types of inducible pluripotent stem cells for regenerative medicine. And that's being done here in California and other places across the U.S. already.
You're not close to acting your age yet.
So is this the chimera stuff seems to have a whole lot of the ethical, moral, what are we doing there? But, you know, the discussion about the stem cells is interesting because you go back 10, 15 years ago, and there was a whole lot of ethical, moral dilemma in there. And it seems like, in some sense, the technological advance has allowed us to just not to answer the ethical problems, because now it seems like we don't need to have embryonic stem cells at all. Is that correct, or am I?
I mean, we're rapidly moving in that direction with the work in induced pluripotent stem cells, and then also what we are learning about adult stem cells and their multipotency.
Mm-hmm.
There still would be people that would argue that there has to be some role for embryonic stem cells, but it's a highly reduced role. And in my mind, years ago when I was first starting with the ministry, I did quite a few radio and TV appearances and debates on the whole stem cell issue. And, you know, this is an example of where I think the Christian community has been really effective in actually steering technology, mm-hmm. because it was the pressure applied by religious groups about the ethical and moral issues working with embryonic stem cells that kind of encouraged a number of scientists to look for other alternatives that didn't have the ethical baggage associated with it. And lo and behold, the technology essentially took us away from a domain where there were some really significant ethical issues. And, you know, I think AJ is right on. Oftentimes I find that Christians react to these kind of emerging biotechnologies out of their gut,
mm-hmm.
without actually taking the time to really understand the science. And usually when you understand the science, it goes a long way towards helping you to really pinpoint whether or not there is an ethical issue, mm-hmm. and what that ethical issue actually is, so that you're appropriately engaging the scientific community.
Well, your point is well taken, and I'll just say it again because I think it's worth emphasizing, is that this is an area where, by Christians knowing enough to be involved and how they got involved, and other religious as well, but really did make a significant difference, that it took it from this dilemma where it was either we're going to help people and kill babies, or we're going to not help people and allow babies. I mean, it's just this unwinnable ethical dilemma, to one where understanding it allowed, or, you know, it pushed us to something where now that's not the choice to be made. Mm-hmm. And I think that's significant.
Yes.
But you're still not recommending we sign up for a brain transplant.
No. Definitely not.
I'm not sure there's anybody that would want my brain.
I think your brain's just fine the way it is, Hugh. I think I'd keep the one I had if I had yours.
I had one final question. I know we're going kind of late on this one. Would this answer the question that is raised sometimes when people ask, why did God create so many species that have apparently similar amounts of DNA in common? Mice share so much, what is it, 90, chimps share 96%, 99% of DNA in common with humans. Here we have pigs apparently share some kind of DNA component with humans as well. Could it be that God endowed these creatures with this DNA component for these very purposes so that we can tap into these resources to help alleviate human suffering, AJ? I pose the question.
I think that's not an unreasonable speculation.
Okay. All right.
It's like four levels of negative. No.
All right. Well, we'll leave it at that. Fascinating stuff. Is there any more coming out of that then? They're hopeful.
I certainly expect them to be publishing more. I'll be interested to know how the data moves forward as they actually start to address.
You said 2014 is
pig knockouts. They've certainly been talking about doing the pig knockouts and supplementing in human pluripotent stem cells to see if they can generate human organs. So either they've begun those and then they're disappointed in the results, or they're still trying to fine-tune the methodology before they actually jump in and try that. So.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. All right, Jeff, we'll move over to you now, and looks like you got a study on planetary formation models. It's always exciting stuff. I know you got a book coming out on exoplanets soon, and looks like Earth, again, looks like it's going to be one of those rare places where we have a life-supporting planet. So tell us about this one.
Yeah, well, what I find interesting about this study is that it addresses a more recent idea that, we're going to find lots of planets where life is going to be, or that are favorable for life. And it's something that's a relatively significant shift over the last 30 or so years, is that I remember when I first started listening to, reading and listening to RTB materials, that one of the distinguishing characteristics, or one of the criteria that Hugh listed, was that you got to have a single star as opposed to binaries. And there's, I think the term thrown, or the number thrown around, was that roughly 66% of all stars are binaries. The challenge in that statement, or what's kind of come up, is that we've discovered that there's all these lightweight stars, stars that are very low mass. We call them dwarf stars now, or M dwarfs are the numbers, or red dwarfs that are typically what they're referred to. And what's interesting about them is that because they're low mass, they have very low luminosities. They're typically anywhere down to, in like 10 to 50 to 70% the mass of the sun. Because of the smaller mass, they have a lot lower luminosities. That means they give off less energy. That means that the planet, any sort of habitable planet, would have to be much closer to them. And so you run into tidal locking and other sorts of issues. But the neat thing about these M dwarfs, or red dwarfs, is that they're incredibly numerous. Roughly 75% of all the stars in the galaxies are red dwarfs. And they tend to come in single systems, so they don't tend to form binary stars very often. And so that kind of, where the number of partners seem to be an argument against finding another star where there's going to find a habitable planet, these M dwarfs, because they're single, somewhat mutes that particular criteria, or at least taken in isolation. And so, the other cool thing about M dwarfs is because they are dimmer and lighter weight, it's actually easier to find lighter weight planets around them. And so a lot of the Earth-sized planets that we have found have actually been around M dwarf stars. Two reasons, or two things about that. One is that because the planet or the star is lighter, you can see the influence of the Earth-sized planet more easily. And also, because of the habitable zone is closer to the star, we're able to find Earth-sized planets in the in that zone where they receive enough radiation that conceivably have liquid water on the planet. So from an observational effect, they're just easier to work with, if you will. And so with the discovery of those, a lot of people started asking the question, are we going to find habitable planets around these M dwarf stars? And, again, you've got to deal with tidal locking effects that because the planet is closer to its star, it ends up over a relatively brief period of time, astronomically speaking, such that the same side of the planet always faces the star if you're in that habitable zone. And that causes some problems, and so people have argued, well, maybe there's the day-night dividing line where you're going to have habitable, where you're going to have liquid water, those sorts of things. But one big aspect of these lighter stars is that they have a lot more activity to them. They give off a lot more X-rays and ultraviolet radiation, which has been known. That's nothing new. And typically an atmosphere will filter a lot of that out for the surface there. And so you could argue around that. But this particular study was looking at how does the increased ultraviolet X-ray UV activity affect the types of elements or the composition of the atmosphere. And so, there's a number of things that happen on a lighter planet. Or sorry, again, there's just a lot of context for getting what's going on here. But one of the things that a planet, or in considering if it's a habitable planet, is that it must be large enough. Because if it's not large enough, what will happen is that all the lighter elements, the gaseous lighter elements, are going to just drift off into space. And since water is a gaseous element or a gaseous compound, that if the planet is not massive enough, it's not going to have enough gravity to pull at the types of temperatures you need, and all of the water molecules are going to evaporate off into space. So that's one problem you got to worry about. And that would be, kind of thermal evaporation. When you're dealing with these M dwarf stars, though, another problem you have to deal with is non-thermal evaporation, because what will happen is these energetic X-rays and ultraviolet photons will come in. They will actually do two things. They'll break molecules up, so they'll split water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen, and then because hydrogen is very lightweighted, it will evaporate. So that's another kind of thermal issues. But the other thing it will do is it will actually just come in and ionize molecules. And so, you've got an oxygen atom that has 8 protons. It's going to have 8 electrons around it. Well, typically they're going to be joined together. You're going to have it in something else, so it'll be a bit larger. But it'll come in and it'll knock the electrons off. Electrons are very lightweight. They will tend to escape off into space. That causes a net charge to the remaining particles, because like charges repel one another and opposite charges attract. As the electrons are flowing off into space, you've got an accumulation of positive charge. The positive charge is going to repel other atoms out into space as well. The net effect of all of this is that within a few tens to maybe 100 million years, the increased activity of these stars is actually going to drive all the oxygen, all the carbon, all the nitrogen out into space. And so you end up with a planet that appears to be in the habitable zone, or well, it is in the liquid water habitable zone, would appear to be habitable from that standpoint, but its atmosphere or all of the components of the atmosphere that are favorable for life are going to be stripped off. And this is going to happen during the formation stage as well. And so you're going to form these planets that just end up not having the element or the composition required for life. And so you kind of have this odd effect where the planets that we can actually see and investigate and study are going to be the ones that are most likely to have had this atmospheric evaporation from these non-thermal effects, or space weather is what it's being referred to.
Is this going to be true for all these dwarf stars?
Yes, in fact, the dwarf stars are particularly affected. The larger stars tend to get away from this very violent activity, or not violent, ultraviolet X-ray activity relatively quickly. And because the star or the planets are further away, they're exposed to less of it. Because, you know, again, the problem with an M-dwarf is that they're more active for longer, but also the planets are much closer to them, and so they experience it much more violently. And so this, just what it amounts to is that just because a planet is in the habitable zone and could potentially support liquid water, we're finding an increasingly large number of ways where all the water is not going to exist for one reason or another. In this instance, all the hydrogen is going to escape to space for one reason. All the oxygen molecules are going to escape off into space for another reason. And so you're going to end up with not having the atmospheric composition you need for liquid water to exist.
Hey, oh, Joe, really good paper here. They're making the point that, yes, the M stars are impacted most dramatically, but the K stars also are impacted, the slightly bigger stars. And basically the paper ends by saying we need to do a lot more research on the activity of young M-type stars, the smallest ones, the K-type stars, which are a little bit bigger, then the G-type stars, which are stars that are as big as our star, the Sun. And so could it be that we have an exceptionally low activity star? We need to do more research and see what's going on here. And so this activity that Jeff is referring to could impact a lot more than just M-type stars.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it's best to put the word habitable in quotes, huh?
You know, it is. And in fairness, when you look at a lot of the scientific literature, they talk about potentially habitable planets. But that distinction often gets dropped and or missed in the more popular literature about them. So the more popular summaries of the actual papers. So I did think it was interesting. One of the authors of the paper on a NASA article says, you know, we have pessimistic results for planets around young red dwarfs in this study, but we have a better understanding. As we learn more about what we need from a host star, it seems more and more that our sun is just one of those perfect parent stars to have supported life on Earth.
How about that? Pretty nice, huh? Okay, good stuff. I think I'll rest comfortably right here on this planet then.
Yeah, we don't have to worry too much about that.
It is a it is
at least
a
not habitable. For now. I mean, our activity level will go up in the future, Joe.
All right.
Another 20,000 years or so?
No, more like a few hundred million.
We're okay for now. Thank you.
So you can rest easy for a few million years, Joe.
Thank you.
Eat, drink, and be merry, for in 100 million years, you'll die.
Or less.
By then, those chimeras will be kicking in, huh?
They better be radiation resistant, though.
Or the Greek chimera will be in effect by then, huh? All right. Thank you, Jeff. Okay, we'll kick it over to Fuzz now. Fuzz, if I got the drift of this one, this is some type of protein misbinding study with evolutionary implications?
Yeah. This is actually a really exciting paper that was published by a team of scientists from New York University. And the implications of this work are really far-reaching. Number one, it helps us to respond to what I think to be one of the most significant challenges to an intelligent design / creation approach to biology, but also at the same time can be used to argue for just how remarkably elegant genomes of organisms are. And to kind of set the stage, at last year's AMP conference, I gave a talk called How the Greatest Challenges Turn into the Greatest Opportunities for the Gospel. And if people want to hear that talk, they can go to our YouTube channel and download the talk. But by the way, the AMP conference is coming up in a few weeks, so I don't know if people will be hearing this before the AMP conference. If you are, there's still time to register. There's a great lineup of speakers.
February 24th and 25th, 2017.
Yeah, so people really want to check that out. But anyway, in that talk, I illustrated that the principle that the greatest challenges can turn into the greatest opportunities for the gospel by talking about three areas that relate to the question of human origins. That about 20 years ago, the concepts surrounding those areas really represented what for many people saw to be insurmountable challenges to the biblical understanding of human origins. But over the last 20 years, there have been scientific advances that have turned those challenges into opportunities to argue for the scientific credibility of the Christian faith. And one of those areas related to something called junk DNA, the idea that there are these non-functional sequences in genomes of organisms that arise through random biochemical events, through physical and chemical insults to the DNA that turn functional DNA into non-functional sequences. And you have these DNA sequences that are so-called junk that are shared between humans and other organisms. And when you put that all together, many people see that as being really compelling evidence for an evolutionary history for humanity. And in fact, in 2003, when the people declared that the human genome sequence was quote-unquote completed, for AJ's benefit, they argued that about 95% of the human genome consisted of junk DNA. And for people that have followed the ministry over the years, you know that from that point in time onward, about the last decade, there have been these studies that have been accruing bit by bit that indicate that most classes of junk DNA seem to have some kind of functional utility. But that all came to an apex, so to speak, in the fall of 2012, when the phase two results of the ENCODE project were published, where people declared that 80% of the human genome was biochemically active. And the ENCODE scientists interpreted that biochemical activity as corresponding to function, with the expectation that probably most of the human genome, when everything is said and done with phase three results, will indicate basically a fully functional genome. Now, almost as soon as those results were published, there was a backlash that came from evolutionary biologists who criticized the competency of the scientists performing the ENCODE project work. They were criticizing the design of the ENCODE project studies, the way in which the results were interpreted. They claimed that there was sensationalization going on of the results. And part of the criticisms related to how do you define function in a genomic context. And they argued that just because there's biochemical activity going on doesn't mean that that activity was functional. And let me illustrate this. When we talk about three of the assays done by the ENCODE project, they did a total of six assays to measure genomic function. Three of them involved protein binding. Transcription factor binding, these are proteins that bind upstream of genes typically and basically will either turn the genes on or turn the genes off. So they play an intimate role in gene expression. The scientists also looked at histone binding sites. Histones are these protein complexes that help to organize the DNA into larger structures called chromosomes. And then they also looked at what are called modified histones and the way that those modified histones binded and saw quite a bit of binding activity, which again the ENCODE project interpreted as function. But the problem here that ENCODE project skeptics raised is that it's possible, in fact, most likely, that most of that binding is actually random and non-functional binding. And to illustrate that, let's say you have a particular protein that binds DNA. It will typically bind anywhere from 1 to about 100 sites in the genome. But the human genome is 3.2 billion genetic letters, and these binding sites are anywhere from 4 mers to 10 mers, meaning 4 genetic letters to 10 genetic letters. So they're relatively small in size. And so statistically, in a genome that's 3.2 billion genetic letters, there can be a huge number of binding sites that would be imposter binding sites, as these researchers refer to in the paper, not the actual target sites. And in fact, if you start to vary that binding, target binding, by altering 1 or 2 genetic letters, you can create hundreds of slight variants of that target site. Plus, you can have thousands more that are lower affinity target site or imposter target sites. So the point is the genome could be littered with non-functional binding sites. And so they argued on that basis that probably most of the binding was random and non-functional binding, and that the ENCODE project was incorrect in arguing that that binding was functional. Hmm. Now, at that time that this challenge was raised, I actually wrote a series of articles. So if people want to read them, they can just go to our website and search ENCODE, and they can see my response to some of these criticisms. My response at that time as a biochemist was intuitively that criticism didn't seem to be valid, because if you have random binding of transcription factors, let's say, throughout the genome, that's going to be so catastrophic and disruptive to genome function that natural selection, just even from an evolutionary standpoint, should weed out that non-functional binding. It's going to be, again, that disruptive. This is where this new work comes in, because these team of researchers from New York University specifically measured the number of non-functional binding sites in genomes of 75 different organisms that represent every major group of organism on the evolutionary tree of life. And interesting work in which they basically did these binding assays. This is actually really incredible, where they took an eightmer, as a binding sequence. So this would be eight genetic letters as the binding site. And they looked at every possible variant of that, which would be almost just slightly less than 33,000 potential sequences. And they took a sample set of binding proteins from humans, fruit flies, mice, and yeast. And they basically measured the binding affinities for all these sample proteins with all these different binding sequences. And what they discovered is in the genomes of humans, mice, fruit flies, and yeast, that the impostor binding sites, which would have high affinity, basically were absent from the genomes. That the higher the binding affinity of the impostor site, the less likely it was going to appear in the genome. They then surveyed, again, the 71 other genomes using statistical methods, and saw that relationship held up across basically every major group of life, arguing that this is actually a defining characteristic of genomes. In other words, the binding sites in genomes are highly specific sites that are basically the targets for that protein bind, or that DNA binding protein. Or if they are impostor sites, they have such low affinity that those proteins aren't going to bind to those sites anyway. Or if they bind, it'll be a very weak association. And so they then tried to ask the question from an evolutionary perspective, could neutral evolution explain this? In other words, just random DNA mutations, could that create this kind of pattern? And the answer is no. It looks as, from an evolutionary perspective, natural selection has weeded out basically non-functional binding that would be high affinity binding. Now, they also then explain why this makes sense. One of the reasons was essentially what I was intuitively arguing. That is, they call it the interference effect. That if you start having proteins binding all over the place, it's just going to muck up the DNA metabolism. It's just going to create a mess. And so that would be deleterious and basically would be eliminated. Another effect that they identified, which I didn't recognize initially, but in retrospect, reading their argument makes a lot of sense, and that's called the titration effect. That if a protein can bind randomly throughout the genome, it's very unlikely it ever will find its actual target site. And so therefore, that also is harmful. When you combine those two, this provides the biochemical rationale from an evolutionary perspective, even why those high-affinity impostor sites would be rare in genomes.
That titration effect would also be incredibly energetically expensive.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's a really good point. So, you know, from an apologetic standpoint, number one, I think this study really paints a picture of the genome as being a highly optimized system. It's not a cobbled-together kludge job, but appears to be an exquisitely optimized system in ways that we haven't even begun to appreciate. this is just a glimpse into how elegant these genomes are. Now, evolutionary biologists would argue natural selection shaped this optimization. I would argue as a creationist that it was the hand of God that shaped the genome in such a way to be optimal. But this is where I think the most significant part of the work comes into play. It means the criticism of the ENCODE critics that the binding was random is not valid because the genomes are basically structured in a way to avoid non-random binding, meaning the binding that was measured in the ENCODE project is actually functional binding. Mm-hmm. And this is three of the six assays that were measuring protein binding. And so this, to me, gives even greater strength to the original conclusion of the ENCODE project that most of the genome is probably functional. And so to me, this is absolutely incredibly significant because it's really, I think, affirming this idea that, number one, the junk DNA concept is a dead concept, but it's really eliminating, I think, one of the most significant challenges to intelligent design or to a biblical creationist perspective of biology.
What's really interesting to me, Fuzz, is that what you just articulated in that entire description that you gave and the way that you led off with the whole concept of junk DNA is that, you know, scientists, preeminent scientists now are coming out and saying, you know, we blew it. We never should have called it junk DNA. And it's sort of that paradigm, that commitment to the evolutionary paradigm that really smart people are looking at the data and they're not accepting the data at face value that the binding's probably functional, even though intuitively as a scientist you would be led to that conclusion. But they're so immersed in the paradigm that they're saying, no, it must be irrelevant binding. It must be non-functional binding. It must be junk. But, you know, they're coming out at first saying ENCODE's got to be wrong, and now they're saying, oh, well, ENCODE's got to be right. And coming out saying it's junk, coming out saying we need to retract that. But even though they're retracting it, what they're not doing is they're not following through with this acknowledgement that an evolutionary paradigm is actually leading them to make statements that's basically shutting down the robustness of the scientific discovery that's staring them in the face if they're just looking at the data without that bias.
Well, and I can't tell you how much ridicule I've received for arguing that the ENCODE project results are credible and from a number of different camps. And yet it's gratifying to me to see that holding my ground, you know, I'm not the only one holding the ground on the validity of the ENCODE project results, but holding my ground is paying off.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm holding my ground not because of a dogmatic commitment to ID or to creationism. It's because it makes scientific sense.
The data makes coherent sense through that lens.
You know, about 2 years ago, I did a debate at North Dakota State University on Darwin Day with P.Z. Myers, who's a very well-known evolutionary biologist and atheist.
Hey, Darwin Day is coming up.
It actually was Sunday.
Yeah.
You missed it, Hugh.
I missed it.
All the fun. But anyway.
Happy Valentine's Day today.
Yeah. but anyway, you know, when we got into the discussion part of the debate where we were going back and forth, the ENCODE project came up. And P.Z. Myers, again, was just ridiculing me, even though
that's who you were debating?
Who I was debating. And he was just ridiculing me for saying it just doesn't make biochemical sense to say that it's non-functional. And he basically said to me, we know that the ENCODE results can't be correct because if they are correct, then evolution can't be true. But because evolution is true, the ENCODE project results can't be true.
Wow.
And what became evident to me at that very moment is science. When it comes to this particular area of genomics, the whole scientific paradigm was turned upside down. Instead of the data evaluating a theory, now the theory was being used to evaluate the data. Hmm. And if the data didn't match the expectations of the theory, it must be wrong. And the scientists that have done that work must have done a poorly designed study, or they must not be competent in their area of expertise. It's remarkable to me to see ENCODE skeptics literally criticize the scientists that are involved in the ENCODE project. And there's like 450 scientists that are top-notch scientists from around the world that were doing this work. To say that those scientists don't understand biology, they don't understand genomics, is almost ludicrous, but that's the type of criticism that's being leveled against the ENCODE project workers, because the results that are coming in cannot be compatible with standard evolutionary theory.
Mm, yeah. Fuzz, I wonder if you could repeat something for me as a layperson, because there's a lot of science discussed here. When you were talking about the 75 organisms, they studied one and then they applied that to all 75. What was it that you were saying?
Yeah, there's five organisms where they took a sample set of DNA binding proteins from five different organisms. Again, humans, mice, fruit flies, yeast, and there was some kind of worm that I just didn't mention because I couldn't figure out what the worm was. And worm is one of these general terms that doesn't mean anything. Yeah. So I couldn't find what the actual species was in the paper. But then once they had that binding data and they knew what the high affinity and low affinity sites were, they could then survey the genome statistically of 75 organisms or an additional 70 organisms looking for certain sequence combinations. And they didn't see those sequence combinations at the frequency you would expect if they were just occurring randomly in the genome. And so it was not doing an extensive study with everything, but it was once you had an understanding of what the binding sequences look like, then you could then statistically survey the other genomes for them. So this is really the very first study of this type. This is the first time anybody has arrived at this conclusion that imposter binding sites are rare in genomes, that their genomes are optimized for only highly specific targeted binding of proteins. So I'm sure there'll be additional studies that will be carried out to kind of flesh out more of the details. There's a lot more questions to be answered, but that's how they were doing the study.
Okay. All right. And you mentioned you have written on the ENCODE project, and that was the date on that, again, was 2012 when
that was,
project,
yeah. So, but I've,
and you wrote on it shortly thereafter.
Right. I've written like an initial article describing the ENCODE results, but then in light of the criticism, there is four or five articles that I wrote responding to the critics, kind of defending, in a sense, the results of the ENCODE project.
So if people were to type in ENCODE, ENCODE,
right,
you would find...
All caps, yeah, all caps.
All caps, you would find...
You know, Fuzz, I've seen those papers. Having read them, I think it'd be great if they could be put together in a set. That might be a good project to do, is just so people could actually get, say, a white paper that has the whole collection. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I've actually written up this discovery as a blog post for my blog, The Cells Design, and this blog will post March 15th. And in that blog post, I actually collect in a resource section links to all those papers.
Oh, good.
So if people wait till the 15th,
beware the Ides of March.
Yeah, all of those references will be there available. Yeah. And we also talked briefly about the ENCODE project and Who is Adam, the updated version of Who is Adam.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you for that. All right, we've let AJ go. She had an appointment, so you won't be hearing her voice the rest of the podcast, but you'll be hearing Hugh's voice now and another discovery. Hugh, I think you talked about the Eddie Akerin discovery related to this period, I think, on a previous scientific
podcast. I have. This is another research study that actually drives home the point even more specifically.
I thought I had heard you talk about this before, but it's always good to get an update. This
would qualify as an update.
All right, yeah.
I thought it picked something a little less technical than what we've been hearing around the table.
Okay.
Since I'm at the end of this podcast.
You're going to bookend it for us, huh?
You know, people might be a little overwhelmed by the technical details. So this is not a technical discovery. But the other reason why I chose it is it strengthens the points that I was making in my book, Improbable Planet.
Yes, I thought so.
Because we have a chapter there on the Eddie Akerin and the Cambrian explosions. And so this... And basically, the bottom line of this research, it got published in Geology by five scientists from Russia and China. And they're making the point that we've had this idea for, a couple of decades, that what stimulated or triggered the Cambrian explosion of all these new phyla of life was a mineral change in the oceans, where the oceans became more oxygen-rich and more calcium-rich. But the point they make in the beginning of their paper is no one's really been able to take the fossil evidence data and link it tightly with the mineralization data, what's happening in the oceans. And just to review what we covered last time we talked about this, there's an event that any student who's ever taken a geology course will have heard of the Great Unconformity. And the Great Unconformity refers to a dramatic event in the past history of the Earth where there were these huge landslides of material being eroded off the continents and dumped into the oceans. And this is a worldwide phenomenon. They're still not certain exactly what caused this huge dump of continental material into the oceans. But there's a consensus that it chemically transformed the ocean. And that, you know, right afterwards, you got the Cambrian explosion. But what these researchers did is they were able to take new fossil data, date it accurately, and compare it with the dates we already had for this Great Unconformity event. And basically make the point that the last of the Ediacaran animals, the Ediacaran explosion, that was about 575 million years ago, and these animals persist in the fossil record to about 545 million years ago, then they go extinct, and at 543 million years ago, they're replaced by these Cambrian animals. And what their fossil data is telling us is that at 545 million years ago, you got the last of these Ediacaran species, and they're calcium deficient. And their body plans are such that they don't require a lot of calcium, and nor do they require a lot of oxygen in the water. And that, you know, literally right at the Cambrian explosion 543 million years ago, we have fossils of animals that are much more demanding of oxygen and especially of calcium. I mean, you know, as Fuzz has talked about, the Cambrian explosion is where you see this skeletal explosion. Where you have all these different skeletal body plans, shells and interior skeletons, all showing up virtually at the same time. Well, none of that would be possible unless you had a calcium-rich ocean. It takes a calcium-rich ocean to make possible this huge variety of skeletal body plans, where each of the body plans requires a lot of calcium carbonate. And that would include, you know, our skeletal frame. It requires a lot of that stuff. And so, given that we now have both good dates for this fossil transition and good dates for the Great Unconformity, where all this continental land material was dumped into the ocean, combined with the increase of oxygen, they do hint in the paper that the increase in oxygen might not have been ubiquitous throughout the world's oceans, but very large portions of oceans all over the world would have seen the oxygen content rise. And just to give you some background here, before the Ediacaran explosion 575 million years ago, we're looking at about 1% oxygen in the atmosphere. And at 575 million years ago, it jumps up to 8%. But it stays at 8% from 575 to about 544 million years ago. Then it jumps from 8% to 10%. That 2% rise might not seem much, but it takes that 2% rise to be able to have these complex body plans where you've got internal organs, where you've got eyes of all different kinds. I mean, Fuzz, you've written an article about the explosion of eye designs that take place, and they take place right at the base of the Cambrian explosion. Well, eyes are an example of an organ that requires lots of oxygen. 8% oxygen is not going to be adequate, 10% oxygen is, plus all this calcium in order to get animals with these skeletal structures that can support all these complex internal and external organs. So that's kind of the contribution of this paper.
All right. So what was the oxygen level then at the time of the Ediacaran
8%. And then with the Cambrian, it jumped from 8 up to 10.
10, okay. And right now we're...
About 21.
21, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so...
Well, for example, you don't see mammals at the Cambrian explosion. They require a lot more oxygen. Birds. Birds and mammals aren't going to make it with 10% oxygen, at least not the big mammals and the birds that fly in the sky. And so, like the Bible says, creation day five, the beginning of creation day five, let the seas swarm with these animals. And that's what the Cambrian explosion is all about. Well, the Itacarians are also animals, so you got this multiplication of animals. And literally, you're going from microscopic life forms and colonies of microscopic life forms immediately to animals that are up to 2 meters across.
Hmm. So if you were to tie this in, now that you mentioned the Bible, if you were to tie this discovery out of geology into a creation day in some way, how would you see a creator's hand involved here?
This paper is writing about the events at the beginning of creation day five. So,
all right, so God used this how? What was God doing here?
Well, God was introducing animals for the first time on the face of the earth. That would be the Itacarian animals.
More than single-celled.
Followed by the Cambrian explosion animals.
All right, prior to this, we had single-celled animals.
Well, you had cells, but you also had colonies of cells. And some of the colonies were quite complex, where you'd have different kinds of single-celled organisms actually symbiotically relating to one another. But you didn't have things like... animals and plants with multiple organs, where they're large scale and processing a lot of energy.
All right. Because I think that's where people sometimes are not quite sure where RTB fits all this in, is where do you see these kinds of things in your creation model?
Well, that's why you should buy The Improbable Planet, where we specify it.
Yeah.
Well, let me jump in here, and maybe this is getting to your point, or maybe not, but one of the things that I found interesting in about this discovery in light of Genesis 1 is the idea that it's this great unconformity that seems to be the trigger, well, not the trigger, but necessary before
God could intervene.
Before God could intervene and introduce the animals in the oceans, which is rather late, actually, in Earth's history.
Yeah.
I mean, probably 85% of Earth's history has transpired before the Cambrian explosion. One of the things I always found interesting is Genesis 1-2 is describing the Earth as a water world. And, if Moses is writing this Genesis 1 creation account from his own understanding, why not put animals in the oceans right away? Right, why wait till the fifth day to put animals in the oceans after there's the continents forming on the third day, the atmosphere being transformed on the fourth day? Well, I think the insight that comes from this paper and other studies actually explains why you see that sequence in Genesis 1, because it's not till you have the continents that you can have the great unconformity, or the Earth's oceans are not only transformed, but then there's the raw materials in the oceans that are needed to build skeletons and things like that. Or day four seems to be describing a transformation in the atmosphere, which would correlate to oxygenation. So to me, it's remarkable that not only do you see that correspondence between Genesis 1 and the scientific record, but that the sequence of events, which is counterintuitive in our own human understanding, particularly for somebody like Moses who was writing this, makes perfect sense in light of what we now are discovering about why things happen when they happened in Earth's history. So it makes Genesis 1 that much more remarkable.
And what you might like as a West Virginia boy is that, the Himalayas, or pardon me, the Appalachians at one time were as high as the Himalayas. But notice that how much closer they are to the seashore. And keep in mind, the flatlands that are east of the Appalachians, that's a relatively recent event. So if you've got mountains as high as the Himalayas right next to the seashore, I think it's easy to imagine catastrophic tectonic events that would cause massive slippage of continental landmass material into the ocean. I mean, at this point, that's speculative. We don't have the data to really nail it down, but that's kind of the explanation for the great unconformity, is there had to be very steep mountains right next to the ocean, kind of like what you got in South America with the Andes, where they're really close to the ocean, and therefore you could imagine some tectonic event which would cause a huge slide.
Because the Appalachians are very old mountains.
They're very old mountains, but if you go back a half billion years to 600 million years.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting...
They're only, what, 6,000 feet high today maximum, but there was a time when they were competing with the Himalayas.
Hugh, I think we should all have shirts here at RTB that say the great unconformity.
Well,
or is that nonconformist, Jeff? Sorry.
They might think that we're the great unconformity. Maybe with some justification.
I think it'd be pretty cool.
All right. Well, if you'll finance it, I'll wear it.
If you could see the look on Jeff's face right now, it's like it's pained disgust. It's like the poster child for pained disgust.
It's like, I can't believe that Joe's actually saying that.
Please end this podcast. I wanted to ask something else about plate tectonics, because you had to have continental buildup. But
yeah, but with that joke, you lost your privilege of asking.
Oh, okay, all right, okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for that description there, Hugh. It fits into day five. And get yourself a copy of Improbable Planet if you don't have it already. Maybe next time you're going to have yet another discovery on the Ediacaran period.
Well, you know, if you would let me, there were actually three papers published in the last two issues of Geology that actually really strengthened the case for making the Cambrian explosion.
Wow.
I just picked one of the three.
All right. Well, one was sufficient. Thank you for that. All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this podcast. Thank you for listening with us. You know how to contact each of the scholars. They're right there on Facebook, and they have their Twitter accounts, so you can connect with them directly there. On behalf of the team, Hugh, Jeff, Fuzz, and AJ, this is Joe Aguirre. Thank you for your support. We will see you next time on Scientifica.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.